that we're going to release, throw out a couple of our new book,
Yes, Prof. Rez. Oh my
which is
gosh, yeah.
titled The
Yeah.
Discipline of Diagnosis, Cases and Visuals. That'll teach you how to think from the clinical problem solvers. It is being released on Wednesday with the release of this episode,
May 13th,
May 13th,
2026.
2026. And what we request is that, CP Solvers has always been a grassroots movement. And we are where we are because of each of you. This is the honest truth. We self-published this. Let us show the whole medical community and the whole publication community that you don't need a fancy publisher. You don't need millions of dollars. All you need is a pen, a paper, some smart folks, a will, and an amazing community. Go and buy this book and leave a review on it. Whatever that review is, leave it, but buy this book from Amazon,
Can I ask you two questions?
please.
Okay, now we have to slow down, right? Because we have so much enthusiasm. But I want a raw. This is, by the way, if any of you think that this is scripted or prepared, take out the cerumen out of your ears. It's massively plugged. So, Prof. has two honest questions. First, what will the average person getting this book really get out of it? Honestly, what will they get out of it?
They will get a story of what it's like to be a clinician at the bedside, meaning more than just the fancy thinking. There are so many moments that speaks to humanity and to what it is to doctor at the bedside.
I think that's beautiful. And then the inverse, Prof. Rez, what room for growth do you think we'll have? How will version two be better than this version? Raw.
Well, raw. Okay, so I actually think I'm going to be a politician here and not even address version two. But what I think the clinical reasoner or the diagnostician will get from this is some figures that are explained in detail in our appendix
Yeah.
that exist nowhere on this planet. And these figures represent Robbie waking up at 4:30 every morning, drinking coffee with his dog, Gnar, and just thinking of how to simplify concepts in medicine. These are not just lists of diagnoses. These are three-dimensional approaches. And so I think, like, just for the figures themselves, this book is worth reading. They're really special, Robbie. I think putting the appendix with the description of the figures brings your figures to a new life than just looking at the figures.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I feel like when I read this book, I thoroughly enjoy every aspect of it. But if I were new to the RLR CP Solvers community, I would look at the figures and be frustrated. Don't be frustrated. Go to the appendix.
Is it Reza loves Robbie or Robbie loves Reza? It's the best palindrome, you will be so impressed. Oh, it's the mathematician and the magician laying out the art of deduction. It's RLR.
Welcome back, clinical problem solver.
Woo! It's finally happening, Prof. Rez.
What is that?
You know, we put out an initiative to have in order to get to know our audience, and we just really wanted to reduce the distance between us and the people who have been kind enough to tune in and support us. And so far, it's been everybody we know. But today's a real special day because we have a guest who we're meeting for the first time, and it's I'm so glad we're doing this podcast. It's a real treat.
Before you introduce our guest, I thought it was so funny because you texted me. Because just so the audience knows, I think it's our third week in a row doing back-to-back, guest CPSs. And Robbie's like, man, I miss just discussing with you. But we're very much looking forward to today, and we hope to continue this initiative and have 6 to 12 cases where you guys can come on and challenge us and teach us, and yeah.
Yeah, Prof. Rez, I think that I'm glad it's finally happening. I hope Dan inspired many, many, many more people. Dan, thrilled to have you here. Thank you for taking the time out of your Saturday with your kids and your family. We have a little bit of a timeline because I know dinner plans are ensuing after this, but let's hand you the mic to say hello, maybe tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thank you for having me, guys. I'm a big fan. I've learned a lot from you over the years. My name's Dan Kelmanson. I'm a pulmonary critical care attending at UAB Hospital in Birmingham, Alabama, where I'm associate professor, director of the medical ICU, and director of the medical emergency team, which is our rapid response team. My wife Lindsay's a brilliant rheumatologist, and we met as co-interns, and we've been working here together in Birmingham since then. So I'm excited to be here.
And one just quick interesting fact about Dan is that Zalvin, who was just on the last recording, was co-interns with Dan. Steph as well. It seems like that place, I wonder if they also met during intern year. Maybe I should have gone to MGH and I would be married by now.
They also met intern year, and yeah, we're all in the same class. I'm not going to comment on that one, though.
41 and still single. Not single, Liz. I'm
Oh,
engaged
geez, Prof.
now.
Rez. You just, guys, remember this moment. This is the moment that when Prof. Rez never returns on this
Do we need
podcast.
to start over?
I guess we're all, we're all indulging in some secrecy here. I will not disclose Dan's secret fact before we hit record, but it's really juicy, guys. All right, Dan, we're ready to rock and roll whenever you are.
All right, I will present the case exactly how it happened to me. I was working MICU nights, where we also cover the medical emergency team, our rapid response team. I got a page for a med or a rapid response at 4 a.m. I walked to the oncology ward, where the nurse tells me the patient is on BiPAP with 100% FiO2 and has a pulse ox saturation of 80%. I'll pause there.
All right, Dan. I'll get us started, but definitely we'll ask Robbie to layer anything else that he thinks is relevant. First of all, let's just recognize it's 4 o'clock in the morning. Like that's just a time that we shouldn't be awake. And what I've also, I don't know if this is biased, Dan, I'd love your thoughts on this. I feel anytime I'm doing like a long shift, like a 16-hour shift, it seems at the end of the shift, when stuff starts unfolding, where I'm probably not at my sharpest, even though I'm relying on system one and reflexive thinking. Here, it's going to be really important to know how the patient was doing prior to being placed on BiPAP, because we need to assign a tempo to their respiratory distress. And that information is going to be really helpful, but I'll tell you what problem my mind is solving, and that is hypoxemia. That seems to be refractory to BiPAP. So first, I think when we approach hypoxemia, we have to ask the question, is it actual really hypoxemia? Or is this a false value that you're detecting and potentially reacting to? I say that because there are a few, it's rare, but there's been a few instances in my experience where the pulse ox says 80%, and then you look at the patient and they look totally comfortable as if they're not, dyspneic or hypoxemic. And the one time that happened, Robbie, was at our county hospital where when we kept trying to do an ABG, we thought it was a VBG. We kept getting but it was an ABG, and it happened to have that sort of chocolate agar hue to it of methemoglobinemia. So I would say for this patient, first thing is let's make sure we're really dealing with hypoxemia. Unlike dyspnea, which is subjective, hypoxemia is objective. Other reasons you might get a false value beyond hemoglobinopathies, more common reasons is someone is vasoconstricted, like Raynaud's, and the pulse ox just isn't accurately measuring the oxygen saturation. So I would actually look at the waveform and see, is this a good waveform or not? Other reasons is nail polish, et cetera. Once you confirm it's hypoxemia, the next question is whether the lung sings. And we learned this from Robbie's wife, Kara, and her beautiful thought train and hypoxemia. And what I mean by that is if you put the stethoscope on and you hear all sorts of sounds, then you're probably dealing with the parenchymal pleural pathology. If you don't hear anything, it could be that you just suck at the physical exam like me, and you need imaging to show that abnormality that then correlates with the hypoxemia. Then you might be dealing with a silent cause of hypoxemia, meaning radiographically silent or exam silent, like a vascular issue, whether it's a AVM, a PE, et cetera. I'm going to leave it at that, Dan, because I feel like we really need to know what happened before, how was the patient doing, and then we need to understand, were they really in respiratory distress to make us feel this is a real value? And if it is a real value and the patient's not improving and there isn't much in their lung, is there some kind of shunt that's at play?
Wow. Reza, where did you do your pulmonary fellowship? That was
You know,
impressive.
the guy is sitting right before by Robbie. What I teach is from that guy right there.
All right, you guys are rolling. So the patient was on BiPAP with an inspiratory pressure of 20, expiratory pressure of 8, 100% FiO2, and was in fact saturating 80% with a good waveform on the pulse ox. To answer your tempo question, one day ago on admission, he had a normal oxygen saturation. His oxygenation had progressively worsened over the course of the night. He had a normal temperature, normal heart rate, normal blood pressure, but he was tachypneic with a respiratory rate of 28. On exam, he was in no respiratory distress, lungs were clear to auscultation, and notably, he felt completely fine and was not short of breath.
Yeah, I mean, I think we find ourselves in such a profound paradox because if you take this case down and you put it from the patient's perspective, they're sitting there feeling totally fine, yet we've decided to force 20 centimeters of water? I forget what the units are. Centimeters, right? Yeah, centimeters of water pressure right into their mouth. And so if I were them, I'd be like, yo, what are you doing? Relax, take it off. And it's such a powerful paradox between numbers and symptoms. And I think when you're early on in your training or you don't have medical training, you're definitely going to trust the numbers over the symptoms. But gosh, when you have a little bit of time and experience under your belt, the symptoms trump the numbers all the time. And so I'd be really curious as to how this person, especially if this hypoxemia is developing over the course of a short period of time, what its significance is in the patient isn't feeling anything. And it's not just feeling anything, it's also the fact that the most common causes of hypoxemia, namely the problems at the alveolus, are markedly diminished by the fact that this patient has normal lung sounds. Aaron Berkowitz likes to share this pearl on VMR a lot, which is that if you cover up one piece of data and the entire case or argument for a diagnosis collapses, you should really scrutinize that data. So I'm doing that exercise with you, and I encourage all of you to do that, which is to cover up the O2 sat and ask yourself, what are you left with? And I think you're left with an asymptomatic person with a normal lung exam. And so what would I do? I think that really have to scrutinize that piece of data. And that piece of data probably would be best scrutinized by getting an ABG to really understand this patient's oxygen saturation. I think if you're early in your training, you might wonder why an ABG over a VBG. And this is to emphasize that the venous blood gas gives you the venous oxygen, and the venous oxygen is actually a function mostly of tissue consumption. So it doesn't give you an accurate estimate of how much is making it across the alveolar capillary membrane. So I would totally understand anybody who decided not to do this, but what I would do is I would take off the BiPAP, I would check in with the patient, see how they're doing, and if they really are completely asymptomatic, the chances that they're going to have something serious happen to them without proceeding through some symptoms is exceptionally low. I try to bring out the temperature in the room. It's 4 a.m. You want them to have a nice, mellow, happy hospitalization, and I would try to get an ABG. And take it from there. In the meantime, I'm running a quick checklist to see if there is anything that shows up on ProfRes's list of fake outs. And that checklist involves scrutinizing two things: the hands for any clues there, including the pulses to see if there's a perfusion issue to the hand, the nail bed to see if there's a detection issue, the accuracy of the pulse ox itself, and then the medication list. And I think the medication list is probably too much detail and too big a bridge to build now, but I think that's going to be an important aspect of this. Yeah, I'm really, really struck by that disconnect, Dan. I'm really curious where it goes.
I was as well. To answer your question about perfusion, he had normal pulses, appeared to be perfusing well. I was able to talk to him a little bit even through the BiPAP, and he was maintaining well and said he truly felt fine. And before I arrived, they did indeed send an ABG down to the lab. It was drawn on 61% FiO2, so not 100%, but it had a pH of 7.43, PCO2 of 42, and a PaO2 of 51.
I'm so glad it's you, Prof. Rez. Oh yeah, with pleasure. Okay, so I'm gonna have to try to reach deep because I've learned this once before, and I don't know how good I'm gonna teach it. So I'm gonna rely on Robbie to help me out here. But it's great for spaced repetition. Basically, we have to, ground ourselves in some technical stuff. Like when we put a pulse ox on someone's finger, what is that pulse ox measuring? That pulse ox is measuring the waveform of
of hemoglobin. So like it's shooting out some kind of, or it's detecting some kind of deflection of waveform. And depending on what the hemoglobin molecule is bound to oxygen or not bound to oxygen, it'll pick up a specific waveform. I didn't explain that extremely well, but just recognize this, that pulse ox is able to create a ratio of total hemoglobin molecules in the denominator, and then the percentage of those molecules bound by oxygen to give you the saturation. So if the hemoglobin molecule is altered at all, then the waveform is not going to be able to detect it. I just wanted to ground ourselves in this. But now let's compare that with the ABG. Now we're actually sampling the blood. And when you're sampling the blood, you're measuring directly the partial pressure of oxygen. And right away, when you look at this partial pressure of oxygen, you're like, that's quite low. In fact, the danger of looking at a pulse ox and saying someone is doing fine is the following. That like someone might be living at 92%, but if you actually did the ABG, you would actually see that the partial pressure could be much lower. So even though you're like, oh, 92 isn't bad, but it could be bad. And this all goes down to that oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve. So when I look at this ABG, I'm like, okay, there seems to be truly a decrease in partial pressure of oxygen. Then my question goes through physiology. Why would partial pressure of oxygen be lower in the blood? Like a 51 is not normal, right? I believe normal values is north of 60, if I'm not mistaken. And this, can someone shake their head and confirm that? Okay, thank you from our pulmonologist. So this value is low. So then you think about what did Robbie teach us? He said, look, whenever you're looking at oxygenation, just make it very simple. Think of the alveoli. Think of the capillary. And in order for oxygen to make its way into the blood and give you partial pressure of oxygen, there's this nice diffusion that happens between the alveoli and the capillary. So when you have a partial pressure that is low, the issue is either stemming in the alveoli or the issue is stemming in the blood. That's one of two possibilities. In the alveoli, the issue can stem because you have pus, like pneumonia, or you have atelectasis because you have a large effusion and it's compressing the lung parenchyma. So far, based on what Dan has shared with us, there's not a strong hit for an alveolar process. That being said, I don't think you can just rely on your exam. Like I've been corrected many times. So I think it's worth getting imaging in addition to the ABG just to make sure that the lungs are silent. And in a patient like this, adding contrast to just see if there's a PE or not. Like Robbie, you know, we talk about contrast and like, is there kidney disease? This is someone I'm really worried about and I just want to know the answer. And where I would say I don't believe in venous contrast-induced nephropathy. I do believe in arterial contrast-induced nephropathy. All that is to say this, Robbie, and I want to pass you the mic to sort of, go on with my thoughts, but there is something known as the oxygen saturation gap. So in addition to the pulse ox detecting an O2 sat, the ABG, you can calculate what like the measured, it's almost like an Osmolar gap, if I'm not mistaken. And if there's a big disconnect between that, that can be a strong clue to the property of hemoglobin being changed. You see, the problem I'm having right now, Dan, is I haven't thought about this in forever. So like there are thoughts, there's notes, but I can't, or so I just want to apologize to the audience that I'm not articulating myself well, but I'm going to give the mic to Robbie to make that articulation a little more sound.
It's the least deserving apology in the history of time for that. That was such crystal clear, very linear thinking, Professor. I think your standards are probably too high for anybody, really. That was awesome. Yeah, I think my reflections, I'll just kind of layer onto yours, is my first reflection was it's so cool to hear an expert present a case. You can tell like the level of expertise to know when to pause and to bring out the tension is unreal. It's also so cool to see how savvy the clinicians were, because the number of times you rush to send an ABG in a situation like this is not as much as you'd think, because you trust the oxygen saturation. And you don't really need an ABG in a situation of rapid response. You might get that in the ICU when the dust has settled to really understand where you're at. So really cool to see the instinct of the folks. And so I retract everything I said about put back that oxygen now. There is, however, one important fake out for us to know, Which is, how can the PaO2 be false and mislead us? And I actually had a case of this in residency, and it was an oncology ward. It was a patient with acute leukemia, and the leukemic cells, actually, when they sit in the ABG analyzer on the way to the lab, they consume all the oxygen. So it's a cause of a false positive, falsely low PaO2, not because the patient has a low PaO2, but rather they have hypercellularity that causes the potassium to go up when they break down, but also chews up the oxygen. But in that situation, the PaO2 should be the SaO2 should be normal. So there's no reason to doubt that here. And so I believe this patient really has true hypoxemia. And I think you're seeing one really fundamental fact, and that's the disconnect that you outline all the time, Prof. Rez, of dyspnea and hypoxia are the very, very different problems. When somebody has shortness of breath, we know that the differential diagnosis ranges much more than patients who have hypoxemia. So, for example, you can get a short of breath with ACS with no O2 sat issues. But we very rarely spend time on the opposite problem, which is, how can you be hypoxemic without dyspnea? How can you have low oxygen going to your brain and you not be like, hey, I need help? And I find that to be fascinating. And I think fundamentally, it really emphasizes the idea that there are specific receptors in our heart and our lungs that tell us that we're short of breath. And for me, I'm inclined to really study the absence of that to help make progress. And I think it's almost impossible for me to foresee a scenario where somebody has an alveoli full of material that doesn't tickle those receptors and tell the patient, hey, there's something wrong. And so I think not only is the exam an argument that the alveoli are not filled, the lack of a perception that there's a problem is really, really powerful. And the reason I'm sharing all this now is because I think it might influence what I would do in the moment with regards to the BiPAP. And so if we take Prof. Rez's hypothesis further and say, hey, you know, I'm really suspicious of a vascular cause here. And the reason I'm suspicious of it, just for completeness sake, is the patient's not feeling the shortness of breath, so the alveoli are unlikely to be tickled. Their lung exam is completely unremarkable. And so you ask yourself, are you dealing with the vessels that are perfusing the lungs, namely the pulmonary capillaries or the pulmonary artery, or are you dealing with something wrong with the heart itself, and that there might be a right to left shunt? And it's premature to start to speculate on this because it's not an actionable hypothesis in most instances. But let's remember that BiPAP isn't harmless. And whenever you're choosing to install positive pressure into the chest, you worsen conditions that are pressure dependent. So if somebody has a pneumothorax and that's why they're hypoxemic, you want to be careful about putting on BiPAP. That thankfully isn't the case with the normal symmetric breath sounds. But if somebody has a right-sided condition that is pressure dependent, you want to be very careful about BiPAP. And the most common pressure dependent condition on the right side is pulmonary hypertension, which is not a consideration we have evidence for here. But if you are worried that a patient has a right to left shunt, adding intrathoracic pressure may worsen that shunt. And so I'd sit back and say, hold on, what is my indication for using BiPAP right now over high flow nasal cannula? And the main use of BiPAP in hypoxemic respiratory failure is to use it in patients who have pulmonary edema. And I think the case for pulmonary edema in this patient is weak enough that I would say, hold on, what benefit am I actually getting from the BiPAP in this situation? And I don't think there is any. So I would start to think, can we switch over to high flow nasal cannula? Because there's a small and increasingly measurable chance that this patient's extra intrathoracic pressure may be actually part of the vicious cycle that they're in. And let me offload that pressure. So potentially, if they are shunting right to left, that I remove that extra gradient for that to happen. And in the room, I'd be really, really curious about one thing, which is, this patient's probably, as all patients with BiPAP, sitting right up. And one powerful clue to the presence of a right to left shunting is position-dependent shunting. And so what I'm thinking I might do is, hey, let's get you on high flow nasal cannula, get the BiPAP off. And then let's see how you do when you lie down. Because if you feel better and your O2 sat improves when you lie down, gosh, I'm definitely going to get that CT with contrast to look for shunting, as you alluded to, Prof. Rez. But then I'm calling the cardiology fellow and say, hey, I think we need a really, really high quality echo in this kind of acute situation. Is there pathological shunting going on? That was a lot, but yeah, Prof. Fres, go for it, please.
Yeah, can I just, Raleigh, that point you made is so important. I remember at Hopkins, we had a patient who developed shunt physiology. And the reason they developed that is because they had a PE, pulmonary hypertension, and had a PFO. And that led to the hypoxemia that wasn't responding to oxygen. I did look at my notes, and I think this is going to be key, right? You made a beautiful point. You said, look, the patient doesn't look dyspneic. Dan, a master pulmonologist, didn't hear anything on the lungs. So it's really hard to imagine that we're going to find anything that the X-ray or CT scan will show in the parenchyma, right? Now, I think the two hypotheses you and I are considering right now is this shunt because they're not responding to oxygenation, or is this dyshemoglobinemia? Is there an abnormal hemoglobin molecule? I feel like that's where the answer lies. And I remember, and Matt will put up a YouTube video where we talk about this. Like I read this and it just tells you, man, when you read something 4 years ago or 3 years ago, it won't stick. But here's the key. You said it, like the difference between SpO2 and SaO2. SpO2 is like the pulse ox, P, pulse ox. So like really what we need to figure out, and I don't remember how it's calculated off the ABG, is what is the SaO2? Because if the SaO2 is down and the SpO2 is down, this is consistent with shunt, meaning true decrease in oxygenation. And by the way, this PaO2, although we look at that, that's like 1% of all the oxygen that's delivered. And like most of the oxygen is bound to hemoglobin. It's like the small fraction. But if the SaO2 is markedly is like high compared to the SpO2, then we know it's an abnormal, meaning if there's a gap there. So again, SaO2 versus SpO2, I think is going to be key in deciding which direction we proceed.
Like watching Messi and Neymar dribble back and forth. I'm impressed. All right. At this point, I looked up some history on the patient. He was a 62-year-old man with hypertension and peripheral arterial disease who came to his PCP for fatigue. Routine lab showed a white blood cell count of 152,000 with a low hemoglobin of 10 and low platelets of 108. So he was admitted to our hospital one day before I met him for workup of presumed acute leukemia. One day ago, on admission, he had a bone marrow biopsy with results pending, a high uric acid level for which he received allopurinol and ras-bucarase, and had a CT chest, not a CTA, which was only notable for subsegmental atelectasis. And Robbie, I did not test for polytypnia or orthodeoxia, but I am impressed.
You know, I've spoken so much, Robbie. I want to pass the mic to you, please.
Oh my gosh, Prof. Reza, I feel like we get to do so many of these fun cases. I think I have not been this discombobulated in quite some time. I feel like there's so many possibilities, and I don't think there's a clear path. But I'll just share the pings that I got. The pings that I got was to go back and be like, wait, is this real? Because the one time I saw a patient with acute leukemia whose PaO2 was a fake out. But again, just for clarity, in that patient, the PaO2 on the ABG, which here is 51, as low as a fake out, but the SaO2 in that patient was normal. So I'm starting to wonder, wait, is this that situation? And I think that the case for that situation, although intriguing, is weakened by the fact that the hypoxemia is dynamic, that he wasn't hypoxemic when he came in and he is now. And so I'm holding on to that possibility. But more alarmingly, a thing that you pinged, Prof. Rez, is the ras-bucarase. So ras-bucarase is unfortunately a notorious trigger for methemoglobinemia and hemolysis in patients with G6PD deficiency. So this is an important concept to put out there, which is that well, oftentimes when you're giving ras-bucarase, you don't know if the patient has G6PD deficiency or not because it's acute and important enough. This patient's gender, him being a man, puts him at risk for this X-linked deficiency. And what can happen is that ras-bucarase essentially induces reactive oxygen species that both destroys the hemoglobin and the patient gets a hemolytic anemia and also oxidizes the hemoglobin and results in methemoglobinemia. So I think you have that ABG, and I think as you alluded to, one powerful step that you can do right now is to add co-oximetry and look for methemoglobinemia on that ABG. Yeah, and I think those are the two pings I got. Is this real fake PaO2 from leukemia, or is it another fake out from methemoglobinemia? What are your thoughts?
Nothing to add.
All right. So we carry iStat machines. We can get point of care ABGs on our rapid response team. So he had an ABG at bedside on our iStat, which had a pH 7.48, pCO2 33, and pAO2 404. His pulse ox saturation was still 80% with a good waveform. He had a chest X-ray during the Met call, which showed mild bibasilar atelectasis, and as the New England Journal would say, a diagnostic test was performed.
So this is really fascinating, Dan, because one is now the pAO2 seems to have skyrocketed compared to the initial value we got off the ABG, if I'm not mistaken. And quite frankly, if you're out there listening to this episode and you've heard about methemoglobinemia, you've thought about pAO2, and this is really confusing still, you're not alone. Because every time I learn about ferric iron versus ferrous and oxidation versus not, I get confused. Like, what, like in carbon monoxide, what should the pAO2 be? But I always have to re-review. But I'm really excited, Robbie, because now we have AI. So I'm going to ask GPT 5.2, if you were to teach me this in a way where I'll never forget, how would that be? And then I'm going to, internalize it. But for me, right now, I think this disconnect of the O2 sat to the patient's clinical symptoms, to now the PaO2 is strongly suggesting an abnormal hemoglobin molecule. And you've built the case so well that respiracase is like a well-known culprit, one of the most common. So I think getting the co-oximeter would be the next step. And if methemoglobinemia is diagnosed, depending on the percentage of methemoglobin molecules will dictate how you treat it. I think if it's above, like it's like methylene blue, if I'm not mistaken, but then you have to make sure they don't have concomitant G6PD deficiency. Like some stuff is coming to mind. But Robbie, can you better explain this pAO2 404 on the iStat? Like I think that's where we are, but I'm not 100% confident.
Rafraz, I'm going to make a bold claim. I think this is my favorite case of all time because this is the case that I would title the double negative. Two traps in one case. So here's what I would propose to you and what I'd love, Prof. because actually my confidence level is not perfect, but I'd love for you to actually be a judge and criticize the proposal I'm going to share with you about what holes it is. But here's what I think is going on. This patient came in, was fine, but was diagnosed with acute leukemia. And then he got rasburicase, and rasburicase likely induced a methemoglobinemia in him. And it's a classic case of that right now because we look and we see his SAT is 80%, yet his pAO2 is 400. But we have to acknowledge that there's one other gap in addition to the gap between the pAO2 of 400 and the SAT of 80%, which is that the other pAO2 that we got was 51. Why is there a difference between those two? So if you're following me, I'm using a horizontal table of the difference between the pAO2 at bedside and the SAT at bedside. And there's a big difference between the pAO2 of 400 at the bedside and the SAT of 80% at the bedside. That is virtually diagnostic of a disordered hemoglobin molecule, usually methemoglobinemia, sometimes other ones like self-hemoglobin. So that is 99.9% chance. But what about the difference between the pAO2 at bedside and the pAO2 in the lab and the ABG that Dan very, very quickly but shrewdly said was sent downstairs to the lab? Why is there a difference? That difference is because of the hypercellularity of the leukemic cells that ate up all that oxygen well before it went down to the lab. This is a double trap, Prof. Rez. This is the leukemic cells eating up the pAO2 before they get to the lab and the rasburicase causing methemoglobinemia. It's crazy, is what I think. But here's the real tension. Now we have to focus on the patient, right? I don't know what I would do in this situation, Prof. Rez, because I think that in order to get methemoglobinemia from rasburicase, you have a high pretest probability of being G6PD deficient. And methylene blue, which would be the treatment for methemoglobinemia, is contraindicated in patients with G6PD because they can actually make it worse. So I don't envy the situation that Dan is in because I think you have to decide, do you give this person methylene blue if they're at a high level, or not. And I think, yeah, I'm crossing my fingers hoping the methemoglobinemia is less than 10% and we can just support this patient. But know in your back pocket, our favorite substance is the treatment for methemoglobinemia without the ability to use methylene blue, and that's vitamin C. So vitamin C
Just
can
shut up.
be
Is it really? Once
it
again, fucking vitamin C comes to this podcast.
yeah.
I
So I
absolutely hate it. I feel I Dan, I missed 3 cases of vitamin C in the span of 2 weeks.
I have both diagnosed scurvy and I have also had many people ask for vitamin C for their septic shock, so I empathize with you.
But yeah, any thoughts or reflections on that, Prof, as before we hand the mic to the guru here?
No, I just want to share this. This is more of like metacognition. Like I didn't know how to explain the difference between the ISAT
Yeah.
at bedside and the one that was sent to the laboratory. You had that knowledge and explained it so eloquently, and it makes so much sense. But being able to just say, I don't know the difference, would lead you to put it into a search, into an LLM or something, and you'll get the answer. So I think, again, what gets highlighted here is not just brushing stuff off and like, oh, whatever, is questioning it. And as long as you can raise the question, you can get to an answer. But I mean, it's amazing to have my GPT 5.3 here to answer it in real time.
All right, Dan, tell us how wrong we are, please.
Yeah, you guys are good. So good. All right, last one. Blood gas co-oximetry sent down to the lab had a high methemoglobin level of 15%, 1.5. So our patient had two rare causes of inaccurate oxygenation measurements occurring at the same time, with methemoglobinemia affecting his pulse ox saturation and hyperleukocytosis affecting his ABGPAO2. His G6PD screening test was normal both before and after receiving respiracase, but I had very high suspicion given the methemoglobinemia occurring after he received respiracase and G6PD gene sequencing later confirmed G6PD deficiency. He never received methylene blue or vitamin C, and his methemoglobin level and oxygen saturation slowly improved to normal over the next few days. And these two processes of methemoglobinemia and hyperleukocytosis can occur simultaneously in a patient with leukemia treated with respiracase, demonstrating Hickam's dictum. Reza, I'm ridiculously impressed. You nailed methemoglobinemia during your first discussion. Rob, you nailed the hyperleukocytosis. I'll have a few teaching points if you want them later.
I just wanted to say, yeah, we definitely want the teaching points. I just want to say, Dan, that was an incredible case. And we're going to get you a, we're publishing a book, and I'm going to get your address, and we're going to send you this book as a thank you for being on the podcast. Like, really. And yeah, that I learned so much. And I'd love Robbie to say a few words before we get the teaching points from you, Dan.
I mean it. This is, a double trap like this, so accurate, so presented that you essentially brought us to the scene in a rapid response, hectic situation, ultimately teaching us, I think, and reinforcing the key principle, which is like focus on the patient, slow down, don't go bonkers. I think is just yeah, it was a special hour. I think this is unfortunately very counterproductive to the ultimate goal, which is to try to inspire other people to join, because I don't think anybody can outdo this case. Mic to you, Dan.
Well, I would say this whole case, except for the gene sequencing, happened in 10 minutes at the bedside. And I don't think I would have solved this if I hadn't been listening to you guys for the last 6 years and thinking about, what is the actual problem I'm trying to solve. So credit to both of you. Quick teaching point. So his first problem was respiracase can cause methemoglobinemia in patients with G6PD deficiency. And methemoglobin can produce a false pulse oximeter saturation, classically around 85%. His was a little lower. The oxidized methemoglobin cannot carry oxygen, and there is a left shift in the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve so that the remaining normal hemoglobin does not release oxygen as readily to the tissues. This needs treatment if it's symptomatic or if the methemoglobin level is above 30%. His was 15%. The usual treatment, you guys got this too, for methemoglobinemia is methylene blue, but in a patient with G6PD deficiency, which we later confirmed that he had, methylene blue is both not effective and can also actually cause a hemolytic anemia. So the treatment is my old friend vitamin C, which reduces methemoglobin back to its normal hemoglobin form. And the second teaching point was is hyperleukocytosis can produce a falsely low PaO2 on ABG if you don't run it quickly, like the one that was sent down to the lab. is the white blood cells in the syringe consume oxygen in the ABG syringe. This is a lab artifact. It doesn't affect the patient, and it can be avoided by running the ABG on an analyzer immediately after drawing the sample. That's all I got.
Peak. That was unbelievable. I think you got your rheumatology wife like vying for a case of this cognitive magnitude. That was really special. Thank you so much, and I will cherish this for a long, long, long time. And I'll be reading about 2 hours tomorrow morning because of you. So thank you. That was awesome.
Wait, two Middle Eastern hours or 2 actual hours?
Probably 2 Middle Eastern hours, probably.
That's like 10 minututes of you. That's how we translate it, Dan, FYI. But Dan, as Robbie would love to say, sign us out.
Oh man, what's the phrase?
Come up with whatever you want, man.
Thank you and bye.
That's a wrap, folks.